Which Czech parties are skilled at using social media, and why do some politicians get it so wrong? Where should we draw the line over what we share on the internet, and why did some Czech influencers begin spreading disinformation about COVID on Instagram? These are just some of the many topics I discussed recently with Maria Hershmanova, a leading Czech digital anthropologist. I'd like to first look at the connection between social media and Czech politics. It often seems to me that the Czech political parties differ enormously in how well they do social media, with obviously ANO being really good at it. Would you agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that. I would say, maybe this has changed, but for a long time, the best users of social media among Czech politicians definitely was Andrej Babiš and Tomio Okamura. And I think there's a difference between the two, because Andrej Babiš and ANO's communication is obviously very effective, very well planned, very expensive. That's my guess. I don't know, but it looks very expensive. But you can also see that it is expensive, that there is a team of people behind it, like famously Marek Prchal. But Tomio Okamura is maybe even better, because he's really sort of authentic, and he speaks always, it's always himself, and he always speaks directly to the people, and he's everywhere, he's on Facebook, he's on YouTube. So I would say Tomio Okamura was really sort of a pioneer of this kind of communication in the Czech space.
And conversely, are there some parties that still don't get it?
Most of them, probably. ČSSD, ODS, basically all the traditional parties. It's just, it's funny. I think it sometimes goes viral because it's so bad that it goes viral. Like, look at how bad this actually is. Like, it was meant to be a campaign, but it's just a joke.
We've seen a few cases of people saying they're running for president, coming out with pretty bizarre-looking campaigns. For example, Karol Janeček. Also more recently, Tomáš Zima. And pretty much immediately, they are destroyed online. What do you think when you see a case like that?
I'm actually not an expert on political communication or political marketing per se, so probably different people would give you different opinions. But I think this is a phenomenon that's definitely not just a Czech phenomenon. I think we see this happening in US politics all the time, for example. It's basically a textbook like how to become cringe online. If they knew anything about how internet culture works, they would never produce this sort of content. So what they show the target group online is, I'm completely out of touch with who you are and what do you find funny. And they basically, I think, just show the people, don't vote for me because I don't know anything about you at all. I have no clue.
Which of the social media platforms, the main ones, do you think is the worst or the most dangerous? And if your answer is Facebook, is that simply because Facebook is the biggest?
Yes, if you ask like this, then I would say Facebook, partly because it's the biggest one in the, at least in the Czech context, but also because of the politics behind it, also because I think the Meta company, at least in some aspects, have a very problematic approach to various issues that they have on their platforms. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's dangerous. I think that's also another mistake that we make quite often, that we think about the platforms as like either good or evil. But I think the most productive way to think about the platforms is to think them about a tool or a platform or an actor in a much wider network of users, platforms, politicians, media. So,
but Facebook, for example, was used in what many would consider a negative and dangerous way, for example, during the US presidential elections,
definitely,
with micro-targeting. There is a danger in Facebook.
Definitely, because any tool that we use can be misused. Obviously, there are features of Facebook that can be very easily misused. But I think this is, if we look at platforms as a tool, then we can study, you know, how they could become dangerous and also how we could use them for, I don't know, greater good, whatever that means. So I think it's interesting that we usually tend to focus on the dangerous part, but there are obviously other actors, other parties who are also using Facebook to, I don't know, to promote good causes. Facebook social media are, for example, a really great tool for NGOs and charities.
I'd like to ask you about Instagram, which I personally have always regarded as being relatively harmless and kind of shiny. But still, it seems that during the COVID period, there were influencers on Instagram, including these Instagram mothers, who were spreading COVID disinformation. Is that the case, or could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Again, this assumption that Instagram was for a long time seen as sort of the nicest place on internet, as like the place where we just post nice pictures and sort of lifestyle content, and it's all, you know, pastel colored and just generally calming for us. So this assumption definitely is part of the problem. And that, again, that has practical implications that, for example, Meta as a company, they don't pay enough attention to misinformation, or for a long time, they didn't pay any attention to misinformation and hate speech being spread on Instagram, because the argument behind it was this is a political platform where this just doesn't happen. And obviously it happens. My postdoc project actually started 2 months before the pandemic started. So I was originally interested in Czech lifestyle influencers and mostly about the gender dimension of communication on Instagram. But because 2 months into my research project, all lifestyle content sort of disappeared overnight, we could say, it was interesting for me to follow how many of the women that I worked with and that I followed on Instagram, that they sort of turn into a kind of political communication, because they perceived COVID as something that really, obviously, it impacted all of our lives. But I think it's also fair to say that influencers, being an influencer, that was a profession that was very heavily impacted. So a lot of them lost a lot of opportunities, lost a lot of money. So they felt like this is an opportunity for them to sort of speak out. And this is something that they have personal experience with. And over the time, it was really interesting to follow or to observe how some of them have turned to different misinformation, conspiracy sources, like discussing this, spreading this further. Some of them, on the other hand, have tried to sort of inform or educate their publics and do some fact-checking as well. But yeah, it was a really interesting process, and I think this has been happening in the English-speaking context for a while. I've seen it personally happening. I think in the Czech context, it was the point where Instagram became a space for political discussion.
About hate speech, vicious trolling online, this seems to disproportionately affect women internationally. Yes. I presume it's similar in the Czech Republic.
Yes. We have studies that prove we're not different from the global context, that even in Czech-speaking online spaces, women, specifically politically active women, are being attacked more than men, and also the hate speech and the trolling that's directed at women is a different nature. It's mostly, it's more sexualized, for example. It's more also like ad hominem attacks. So when a woman is trying to be part of political discussion, let's say on Twitter, for example, then what she would always face is people commenting on how she looks, on her family status, on the fact that she does or doesn't have children, for example, if she's married. Whereas men would much more easily get to the point of discussion where their actual political opinions are discussed instead of, for example, what their wife does. That's the main difference.
And I presume this has also a considerable impact in real life on the victims of these trolling, which I presume a lot of online people don't think about to any great extent.
Yes, I think there's again this assumption that it's just online, so you really shouldn't pay it any attention. Last year, we did a research about the impacts of hate speech together with my colleagues from the Faculty of Humanities. And so we did interviews with people who have experience with like daily harassment and daily hate speech, both online and offline. And one of the really important takeaways is that there really isn't, in terms of impact on your life and on your psychological well-being, let's say, there really isn't much difference between online and offline spaces. Like, even if people are just being mean or really horrible to you online, it can really affect how you feel in your everyday life. So we had cases of people who have been like targets of really like hate speech campaigns online, and it resulted in them, for example, not feeling safe in public spaces, not feeling safe in public transport, or cases as this. Our online and offline lives are not disconnected. And also the victims of hate speech, they quite often said that, you know, people, when I try to talk about this, and this is really difficult because even when they try to go to the police or when they try to find some help, so the sort of like support mechanisms are not great in the Czech Republic, to be honest. And so when they try to find some support and when they try to talk about, for example, even with their closed one, about what is happening to them, the very common reaction would be, but these are just some people online, like you,
anonymous,
you don't even
nobody's.
Know them. Why do you care? And a lot of people would say, this makes me feel even worse.
My next question is perhaps a bit niche, but I use Twitter and I notice on Twitter, a lot of people, they seem to write deliberately badly. They don't use capital letters. They don't use punctuation. Why are they doing that? And why does it seem to work? Because I often see it with tweets that are big hits. Is it because they want to create the impression that they're tweeting so fast they don't have time, or that they're just so, I don't know, authentic in some way?
For me, it's just part of what I would call internet culture. It's just part of the environment. In all communities, in all cultures, you have some sort of language that you use to define that you are part of the community. And I think using bad grammar or using all caps, these are like practices that have specific meanings on Twitter. They mean something, and by using them, you are beyond just, you know, the actual content of your words. You are also conveying something else to your audience, that you are part of the group, that you know how to use the language of the group. And this is also one of the reasons why so many politicians who are not part of the group so often fail, because they don't know the rules, they are not familiar with the conversation, they don't know what the words mean. They are cultural outsiders, how I would say, as an anthropologist.
Tell me about your online behavior. Are you somebody who puts a lot out, or are you more careful?
I think it depends how you define careful, because I think from some point of view, I'm very careful. From another point of view, I'm probably not careful enough. And I think it's also interesting in my case that I'm a millennial, so I'm part of the generation, like, I didn't grow up online, but I spent most of my adult life online. So I think my generation has a different experience than people who are younger or older, obviously. So when I started to use social media, I was just, you know, and I think we all were, like, this is so wonderful, like, I can tell everything to everyone. And I think most of us learned pretty quickly that this is just, it's not what you actually want to do. So right now, my approach is that I use social media actively, obviously, and I talk about my work, I talk about my research, I talk about my political opinion, but I don't talk about my private life. And the only place where I share something private, which would be holiday pictures, is on Instagram. And I switch between private, public profile on Instagram quite often. But it's, for example, the reason why I don't use Instagram stories, why I was never very active on Snapchat. I try to avoid this sharing of everyday life, like real life, like, this is where I am right now, and this is what I'm doing right now, this is who I'm with. So this is something that I'm trying to avoid. And this is in no way a criticism of people who do it, but this is where I draw the line. This is how I'm being careful.
But it's very hard to know where to draw the line, because I share some personal things online, even on Twitter, which is obviously public. But then I also see other people who I think are crazy because they're sharing pictures of their children almost every day.
Obviously, there is no guidelines or no textbook how to be careful online. It really depends on how you feel and what are your personal experiences and what the platform enables you to do. But if you were talking with, I don't know, cybersecurity experts, then they will tell you we are all crazy, obviously, because we are just feeding more and more data to the platforms. And I'm aware of that. And I think by now most people are aware of that, because it has become part of the popular discourse. The other part of the problem is this is a tool that we like to use, and we like to use it to connect with people. So this is what digital anthropology is about. So in this environment, what do people do? What sort of cultural patterns emerge? And I would, for example, say that there is in the academic community, there is some sort of consensus that children are a very specific area, and that generally we are not careful enough, and that we also don't have enough experience and we don't have enough data on how to treat this issue, because there is a generation of parents who are now constantly online, so they are sharing pictures of their children. Obviously, the children can't give them consent that they want to be displayed in this way. There's also, for example, child influencers. That would be a whole another issue. That's basically child work that's not being regulated at all, which is also interesting for me. But this is, for me as an anthropologist, what's interesting. So where do we draw the line and why, and what sort of practices we introduce to our everyday lives to either expose ourselves and protect ourselves. So the line is different for each of us, I would say.